the following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
She's got the news. She talks with newsmakers. She encourages us to laugh, and she cries with us. Speaking truth to power and questioning authority daily, it's the Nicole Sandler Show.
All right. It's a Wednesday. The middle of the week. Somebody years ago decided to call it hump day, and it stuck. I always hated that term, but I just wrote it in the chat room. All right, so happy hump day, everyone. Welcome to it. We have an interesting guest coming up today. Greg Mitchell is somebody that I met a few years back when he used to write for The Nation magazine. And he left The Nation a few years ago. And I knew that he wrote about media and politics, but it was always with a different slant. Well, his new book was just released yesterday, and it's called The Beginning or the End: How Hollywood and America Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb. Now, that subtitle, you know, is taken a bit from Dr. Strangelove, right? Or you should know, because that's like one of the greatest movies about the bomb ever. But this book is actually about a different movie about the bomb that was called The Beginning or the End. And it was a major Hollywood production back, made shortly after the, we dropped bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So, but it's an interesting take on it because it has to do with the way Hollywood approached this film and how then the Truman administration got in there and sort of took control of the thing. So anyway, that's what's coming up. Our guest today is Greg Mitchell, and we'll talk about this book. But there's a lot of stuff going on before we get there. So let's not wait any further. Let's start with a funny, as I like to do, because you know things get serious as the show progresses. The problem is I've got three different videos to choose from, and while they're all kind of funny and they're all semi-regulars, we have one from the Parody Project, we have one from Founder Singh, and we have one from the Kiffness in South Africa. But they're all a little on the dark side. So I guess I'll just pick. You know what? Let's go with, Founder Singh. Founder Singh just launched, I don't know, a few months back, with a video, a parody of Don McLean's American Pie. That was the animation on the video was wonderful because it was all our founding fathers from, you know, Washington and Jefferson and Hamilton and you know the drill, all animated singing the song. And you know, it's like an 8-minute song, so they all had a verse. So that's where I guess the name Founders Sing came from. Now, beyond that, they've done subsequent videos without the founding fathers, with personalities like, oh, Dr. Fauci and the Obamas and you name it. And today's song is sung by the one and only Jesus Christ. Yeah, because why not? When it's animation, why not, right? And the song is titled today, Amazing Waste. So you know what's coming, kind of, sort of. Anyway, take it away, Founders Sing with Amazing Waste. It says, some evangelicals believe Trump is God's chosen one. Jesus felt compelled to set the record straight. Beware of false prophets, those who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly are ravenous wolves. Every sound tree bears good fruit, but the bad tree bears evil fruit. Something like that. Now the song kicks in.
Amazing waste, that heartless clown who lacks all empathy. He'll pay the cost not long from now of faking he loves me. and paid the porn star's fee. He's rude, he's crude, a total slime. So don't tie him to me. Amazing waste.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, let's get rid of the echo effect. I think. Come on. Echo, go away. There we go. Founder Singh, Amazing Waste. I couldn't have said it any better myself and certainly couldn't have sung it better. Those guys, and I don't know a whole lot about them, but they're Founder Singh. As usual, I will post the video on the blog at NicoleSandler.com along with today's show. So you can see the wonderful animation in case you only heard the audio there. And yes, Jesus was brown, in case you were wondering. Yeah. So today is July 8th. And, you know, on Facebook, they have this, you know, memory thing where it says, see your memories with thus and such. And so it tagged a few people. And I thought, oh, I wonder what this was about. And I looked back and the things that it was showing me were no big deal. But then I got back 4 years. 4 years ago today was a really fucked up day. Oh my God. First of all, that was the day we awoke to a video of a man being shot dead in Minneapolis in his car by police with his girlfriend and her like 3 or 4 year old daughter in the back seat. His name was Philando Castile. Remember him? And we were all shocked. And it and just, that was 4 years ago today. And look what it took. 4 years filled with similar incidents of cops killing unarmed, mostly black people. And so that's how the day began 4 years ago today. But I'm looking through my memories on Facebook, and I see the first thing I see from 4 years ago is sitting in an ER bed watching the madness on TV. It's a sad, mad world. And then a little bit later, I wrote, I'm at the hospital. Looks like they're keeping me overnight. No show tomorrow. And the next one said, classic female heart attack symptoms, left jaw pain, short of breath, awoke in a pool of sweat, like lightheaded, now watching the news in horror. And then I had an update, and the update said, I may have had a minor heart attack last night, being transferred to another hospital for angiogram. Needless to say, no show today. And what happened was, so the next morning, I guess, today, so the thing happened on the 7th. So now it's the 8th. I posted it about midnight on July 8th. So 4 years ago, at from the hospital, and they kept me overnight because the enzymes, whatever enzyme shows up, looked like I had a heart attack. So they wanted to transfer me the next morning to another hospital to get an angiogram. which they wound up doing. So I transferred it. Long story. It was a much longer story than that. Had to fight with United Healthcare for the ambulance to take me to the right hospital, the hospital where my cardiologist was at. So we fought and got it all taken care of. But one thing this hospital didn't tell me is when they did the x-ray of my chest, that they noticed a mass on my left lung. And it wasn't until the next day when I was at the other hospital and there to have the angiogram, you know, the cath, to see if my arteries were blocked, that my cardiologist said, "Did they tell you anything else at the hospital?" I said, "No, just that, just that my enzymes were elevated." And he said, "So they didn't tell you they found a mass on your lung?" No. So that began my journey into learning that I had lung cancer, although it was still another couple of weeks away to get the diagnosis. But it was 4 years ago today that I learned from the other doctor, from the cardiologist, not the doctor at the original hospital that I went to, that I had a mass on my lung. It was also the day that, you know, I joke, I kid. The way that we discovered I had lung cancer was because we thought I had a heart attack. And I went to the hospital and they did this chest x-ray to see if my heart was enlarged. And it showed a mass on my left lung, which started the ball rolling. But what happened was right back then, I had just a couple of months earlier started working with Randy Rhodes at the studio she built up in Delray Beach. We were going to work together and we started on the Progressive Voices Network and all that. And we had a massive blowout of a fight that day. It was the 7th of July. So it would have been 4 years ago yesterday. And that's when I realized this relationship was not going to work. And I got home and I felt really bad. And I told David, I said, "I'm going to lie down. I just don't feel well." All the way driving home, something was wrong. And I laid down, I took a nap and I woke up drenched in sweat. And that's when, you know, we decided that I was going to go to the hospital. But it was also, you know, the joke was afterwards, Randy Rhodes made me have a heart attack. So she almost killed me, but she saved my life. So that's our little joke. If you ever hear me say, "Randy almost killed me but saved my life," that's why. So anyway, I'm coming up in the next couple of weeks. I'm supposed to go in for my quarterly, or now it's a twice a year, CAT scan to make sure I'm okay. What they tell you is when you make it through 5 years post-surgery, or once you go into remission, then you're cured. And it's the only time they ever use the cured word with cancer. So, I mean, long story short, for those of you who are new here, it was August 30th that I wound up having surgery, and they removed two tumors from my left lung. They removed the entirety of the lower left lobe that had the bigger mass, and then there was a smaller mass in the upper left lobe. So they did a wedge resection. And no, Gene just asked, "So was it also a heart attack?" No. And that's the weird thing. The cardiologist did the angiogram and he said, "Your heart's beautiful. There is no problem there." So something intervened to say, you know, go get checked out, because frankly, we caught the cancer so early, even though it was two separate and distinct tumors that were not related. Otherwise, it would have been a metastasized, the second one would have been a metastasized tumor coming off the first one, and would have been a lot worse off. But no, two separate and distinct instances of lung cancer. They were not genetically related, which is the weird thing. But so August 30th will be 4 years since the surgery, and knock on laminate, here I am. So Facebook, as fucked up as it is, has some good reminders every now and then. And especially, you know, being this week the way it was, losing two friends in the past week, I realized just how precious life is and how everything changes in the, you know, flip of a switch in a New York second. So Yeah. Anyway, I'll keep you posted. I'm supposed to go to the oncologist again next week, but you know, got to deal with insurance and getting the referral and the approval for the CAT scan, and so who knows? Because I've been putting it off because of the COVID, because I don't really want to go to anywhere. I don't want to go to any doctor's office. Don't want to go have a CAT scan. Don't want to go to the oncologist's office. But you know, we do what we do. You do what you have to do. All right. So, moving right along, I'll tell you what, I've got news for you. We had the Supreme Court today with five, count them, five opinions left to deliver, gave us two. But they did tell us tomorrow will be the final day for the term that technically ended on June 30th. It will officially end tomorrow. We'll get the last three decisions. I'll fill you in on all of that in just a moment. But let's try to take a break. And I always say try because it doesn't always work. So we'll give it a shot because we need to try to get in some commercials on the Progressive Voices Network. We'll be right back. So Progressive Voices is in ads. While they're in commercials, we'll do this. A little bit of Jim Hightower, okay?
Once again, my state of Texas is saddled with a Republican gubernatorial goober. Greg Abbott is this guy's name, and he's another incompetent right-wing ideologue whose botched handling of our state's COVID-19 crisis makes Donald Trump look like a master administrator of public health. First, as a small-minded, small-government zealot, Abbott obsequiously followed Trump's lead of do-nothingism, pretending the bad thing would just drift away. As a result, droves of Texans were dying, so he rushed out to express astonishment and concern. Yet, he cravenly refused to offend his corporate and far-right backers by implementing such life-saving measures as business closures, requiring masks in public, and stay-at-home orders. Worse, the little petty potentate infuriated local officials by banning them from taking protective actions in their communities. Bizarrely, Abbott declared he was focused not on preventing infections, but on making sure there were enough hospital beds for those who get infected. He might as well have bragged that providing an adequate number of graves was his priority, for sure enough, thousands more Texans were soon dying because of his incompetence. Finally, Abbott the absent was forced to enact a stay-at-home mandate, but he declared it was not a stay-at-home order. Instead, it was essential services and activities protocols. Then he got really strange. After banning local officials from requiring mask wearing, he declared he had hidden a trick door in that executive order. If they could divine the riddle, the trick was that while mayors and others could not require face masks, they could require stores, bars, offices, factories, and other businesses to require masks. This is Jim Hightower saying, isn't that fun? Playing pandemic word games with people's lives. Critics who say Republican leaders have no sense of humor haven't met Greg Abbott.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Ever long for the lawlessness of the Old West? Well, now's your chance to rise above the law. For a fistful of only $60, you can incorporate.
I lost my home and my family. I'm gonna kill you.
Sorry, punk. I'm incorporated. Thanks to your apathy, the Fourth Amendment and your civil rights have been abolished. Corporations now have the rights of an individual.
I got you reading my email. For this, you must die.
Excuse me. Invasion of privacy, such as reading private email, tapping someone's phone, grand larceny, false imprisonment, child rape, even murder. You're above it all. If you're incorporated, be unaccountable and incorporate now. Call 1-800. Do you like my new suit and tie? Well, do you, punk?
This is a huge, huge issue.
And we're talking about it. The Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com.
would help if I turned the microphone back on. Yes, that is Boca Brittany Summers. And in case you're wondering, I know Britt was here with me on Monday. We were both sort of out of our minds a little bit, having learned of the death of George Rodriguez, with whom Britt worked for years on the Neil Rogers Show. In fact, George is who introduced me to Britt. And so he died on Friday afternoon. Yeah, found out over the weekend. Brittany Summers is putting together a massive memorial. We're going to do a broadcast on a weekend. It'll be not this weekend, but next weekend, either Saturday or Sunday. We'll do it here on my streams, on my YouTube channel, on my audio stream at NicoleSandlerStream.com. And we'll let you know where else it'll be. So, yeah, I know Phil Hendry, who was, worked with George at WIOD in Miami, and others will be participating throughout the day. So I'll keep you posted on that. All right. I guess we should get to some of the news, huh? All right. Let's do it.
I read the news today. Oh, boy.
Oh, boy.
We'll do it live.
All right. All right. Thank you, Bill.
Live.
Yeah.
I'll write it and we'll do it live.
Okay. There's a lot of stuff. All right.
Sucks.
All right. All right, Bill. Thank you. Let me start with the Supreme Court, because we got two more decisions today. There were five left. So that gives us three for tomorrow. So the first one they gave us today, they were both having to do with religion in the religion in the public square or something. The first one, the Supreme Court lets employers opt out of birth control coverage. Lovely. And it was a 7-2 decision. The Supreme Court today upheld a Trump administration regulation that lets employers with religious or moral objections limit women's access to birth control coverage under the Affordable Care Act. Lovely. So as a consequence of this ruling, about 70 to 126,000 women could lose contraceptive coverage from their employers. The vote was 7-2 with, of course, Justices Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Sonia Sotomayor dissenting. Hold on. I do have my notes are all over the place on this one. Let me see. What I could find here. This was the second one they announced today. The case was a challenge to the 2017 rules issued by the Trump administration that expanded the exemption from the Affordable Care Act's birth control mandate. And the court let it hold. I'm just blown away. The Supreme Court, let me read to you, in its 7-2 ruling, sought to resolve a long-running legal battle that previously vexed the justices: how to strike the right balance between ensuring access to birth control and safeguarding religious freedom protections. But this explanation from SCOTUS blog, which is where I got this, says, but the court's decision appears likely to revive debate over the culture war issue as the presidential election kicks into gear. Lovely. The other decision was in Our Lady of Guadalupe School versus Morrissey Beru. And this decision was written by Alito. It was a 7-2. This time with Sotomayor and Ginsburg dissenting, so they're just in backwards order. This was a case about whether courts could hear employment discrimination claims brought by two teachers at Catholic elementary schools in California, or whether the teachers' lawsuits are instead barred by the, quote, ministerial exception, which bars ministers from suing churches and other institutions for employment discrimination. And the judges, by a 7-2 vote, decided that the answer is that the lawsuits are barred. Here's the explanation. It says, although these teachers were not given the title of minister and have less religious training than the teacher in another case, an earlier case involving the ministerial exception, quote, we hold that their cases fall within the same rule that dictated our decision in that other case, Hosanna Tabor. The religious education and formation of students is the very reason for the existence of most private religious schools, and therefore the selection and supervision of the teachers upon whom the schools rely to do this work lie at the core of their mission. The sweeping result is this from the dissent by Sonia Sotomayor. Quote, "This sweeping result is profoundly unfair. The court is not only wrong on the facts, but its error also risks upending anti-discrimination protections for many employees of religious entities." She said, "One must hope that a decision deft enough to remold Hosanna Tabor to fit the result reached today reflects the court's capacity to cabin the consequences tomorrow." And she ends it by saying, "I respectfully dissent." And that leaves three cases, which we are told they will hand down tomorrow morning at 10 a.m. So it is, tomorrow we find out if Congress has a right and if the Manhattan District Attorney has a right to Donald Trump's financial records, including his tax returns. That's the one they're saving till the end. There's another case still outstanding having to do with, and forgive me for not having all the particulars yet, but it has to do with indigenous rights, with an Indian reservation. And I promise by tomorrow I'll be up to date on it. Talk about, stretching out the ending. And it certainly is. All right. The other news story that I wanted to tell you about, and there's tons of news. You can just go to NicoleSandler.com and click on what's news to find out, the rest of the news for today. But there is another story that broke since I recorded what's news this morning. And it has to do with Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman. Remember him? He testified in the impeachment trial of Donald Trump, or was it during the inquiry? I think it was during the inquiry. And Alexander Vindman, born in the Soviet Union, his parents brought he and his twin brother over from, I want to say Ukraine, but it was the former Soviet Union, when they were just like 3 years old. And Vindman worked in the NSC. And here's a little bit of his testimony. While he was saying, he was reassuring his father he was going to be okay. He said some of these words in his opening statement. This was, he was asked by Congressman Maloney to repeat that part, that ending of his opening statement. And here's how it went.
You still have your opening statement handy?
I do.
Could you read the last paragraph for me again? Not the one, the very last one, the second to last one. Would you read that one again for me? Because I think the American public deserves to hear it again. That's the one.
I think my dad would appreciate this one, too.
Yeah.
Dad, my sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected officials is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I'll be fine for telling the truth.
Wow.
You realize when you came forward out of sense of duty that you were putting yourself in direct opposition to the most powerful person in the world. Do you realize that, sir?
I knew I was assuming a lot of risk.
And I'm struck by that word, don't worry, that phrase, do not worry, you addressed to your dad. Was your dad a warrior?
He did serve. It was a different military, though.
And he would have worried if you were putting yourself up against the President of the United States. Is that right?
He deeply worried about it because in his context, there was the ultimate risk.
And why do you have confidence that you can do that and tell your dad not to worry?
Congressman, because this is America.
Yeah.
This is the country I've served and defended, that all my brothers have served, and here, right matters.
Here, right matters. Here, right matters, he said. That was Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, who today announced that he's retiring. He said, all right, citing a campaign of, quote, bullying, intimidation, and retaliation by Donald Trump after his impeachment testimony. just reading from the New York Times, the Army officer who had been attached to the National Security Council testified in the impeachment hearing that he was disturbed by Trump's call with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, in which Trump asked for an investigation of former Vice President Joe Biden and his son. Some government officials had recently expressed concern that the White House planned to veto Vindman's promotion to colonel in retaliation for his role in the impeachment hearing. And actually, we heard Tammy Duckworth put forth an amendment saying she's going to, or put, made a statement and said she's going to hold up every military promotion unless she gets an assurance that Vindman's promotion will not be flagged, will not be held up. And today we learn that Vindman is retiring. Retiring. We should all be ashamed. I just hope that when a new administration comes in, that they will reinstate Vindman and promote him as he should be promoted. This is sickening, but it just goes along with everything else from this administration. It's all sickening. It's all just sickening. All right. One more very quick timeout for our friends at the Progressive Voices Network, and we'll be right back with Greg Mitchell and the beginning or the end. It's a question I ask myself all the time. It sounds like a song lyric too, doesn't it? We'll be right back. All right, so while Progressive Voices is in commercials, we'll get a little labor history in two, and we'll be right back.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1939. That was the day AFL President William Green called all affiliates to meet in Chicago. Green sought to mobilize union leaders in a fight to restore prevailing wages on federal relief projects. Building tradesmen on WPA construction sites had started walking off the job in spontaneous strikes across the country 3 days earlier. The strike spread rapidly to 36 states, quickly turning into a nationwide walkout of over 150,000. Workers were outraged by provisions in the latest federal relief bill titled the Woodrum Act. New terms established the 130-hour rule, essentially slashing wages by more than half. It also called for a 30-day dismissal of all workers who had been on WPA rolls for 18 months. The AFL Building Trades Department stated the act would, quote, destroy national wage standards established through 50 years of collective bargaining. IBEW leader Daniel Tracy added that forcing a lower wage on federal relief workers would only aid building contractors in private industry to do the same. From St. Louis to Rochester, from Minneapolis to Akron, picket lines were solid. Organizers worked to build solidarity among unskilled WPA workers affected by the new starvation bill. Tens of thousands of strikers were fired in WPA-ordered dismissals. President Roosevelt declared there could be no strikes against the federal government. Attorney General Frank Murphy, former Michigan governor during the Flint sit-down strike, declared that striking against the government would build a fascist psychology. WPA administrators also threatened organizers with federal prosecution, fines, and jail time. But New York's Building and Construction Trades Council leader Thomas Murray authorized a strike of 32,000. He avowed, "This will be a strike to the finish."
This is a huge, huge issue.
And we're talking about it. The Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com.
Aha! And we are back, and I'm thrilled to be joined by our guest today. It's Greg Mitchell, who has got a brand new book out called The Beginning or the End, How Hollywood and America Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb. Oh, there's a picture of it right up on the screen, so I don't have to actually hold it up. Hey, Greg, thanks so much for joining us today.
Very happy to be here. Thank you very much.
Oh, it's my pleasure. So congratulations on the book. I know it just released officially yesterday.
That's right.
And you had some really nice press, including a lovely piece at Mother Jones. And let's back up a second. The book is about a movie that, frankly, I had never heard of before. And I was a little confused by the title before I opened the book and started reading it, because The Beginning or the End, How Hollywood and America Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb. Now, I'm a big fan of Dr. Strangelove, and that sort of well, it borrows a little bit from Dr. Strangelove, or what was it, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb. But this book is not about Dr. Strangelove, which was a brilliant movie, but about a movie called The Beginning or the End that was a huge, big-budget Hollywood production that was a major, well, pardon the pun, bomb, right?
That's right. Yes, yes. It was came out from MGM in early 1947. And the book tells the tale of how it came to be and how it started out as a based on warnings from the scientists against the further development of the bomb, making more powerful bombs, nuclear arms race, concerns about the use of the bomb against Japan. Actually, in a letter from a Manhattan Project scientist who was Donna Reed's, the actress Donna Reed's high school chemistry teacher, and he wrote her out of the blue in Hollywood and said, "You must get a movie made to stop this craziness from going forward." And sure enough, her husband was a Hollywood agent, so he was able to sit down with the legendary MGM chief Louis B. Mayer, signed off on the movie, said it'd be the most important movie he ever made. The first scripts then were very much aligned with the scientists, took that warning to heart. And then over the course of the next year, after the intervention by the military and President Truman himself, the movie was transformed into pro-bomb propaganda and tried to settle this question forever of the dangers of nuclear weapons. And of course, we've kind of seen what has happened since.
Well, that's a mighty big question, and I don't know that we've fully answered the question. But the movie. I'm interested in, and it's a fascinating topic. I mean, when I got the book, it's like, wait a minute, is this about the nuclear arms race? Is this about Hiroshima and Nagasaki? Is it about a movie? But it's actually about all three. So the movie, after we bombed Japan so horrifically on two occasions, two movie studios decided they were going to make a movie, the be-all and end-all movie about the bomb. Was that organic to the one that got made? If it was MGM that you talk about, but you said also, I think it was Paramount that was also having another script written, that one by, of all people, Ayn Rand.
That's right.
Never got made. Was this just organic that two studios said, "Oh, we dropped two bombs. Let's make a movie about it"?
Well, this was seen perhaps accurately at the time as the most important development in human history in hundreds of years, you know.
Yeah.
We have to understand that when the bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, no one knew this even existed. So on the same day that the bomb was used, the world also learned about nuclear energy, atomic fission, splitting the atom, and so on and so forth. So so the people afterwards were legitimately concerned and worried about the future of the world, as well they should be. But the official narrative of Hiroshima that came from the White House and the military was that the use of the bomb against Japan was absolutely necessary. It ended the war. There were no other options. And the people, the vast majority of people, accepted that. They wanted to get on with the post-war era. And so this became kind of written in stone. And then here was this movie that threatened that narrative. And also in that 1946, that crucial year, came John Hersey's famous New Yorker article about Hiroshima, which has been called by some people the most important article ever in a magazine in the century. That too raised questions about the use of the bomb and future use and radiation, which is something we were poo-pooing at the time.
Wow.
So 1946 was a year of great threats to this official narrative. So the book really follows, in following this movie, which, as you've said, few people have heard about, even though it's shown on Turner Classics.
Is it?
It's streaming. You can see it.
Well,
it exists. Just in looking at this one movie, we can see how that official narrative was developed, how it was threatened, all the different arguments, and then how it was overcome thanks to Truman and the Pentagon. It became written in stone, and 75 years later, we haven't, at least in the public opinion, gone that far beyond it.
No. And in fact, so look, obviously, I rarely can say this anymore, but it was a little before my time. Yeah, but still to this day, as horrific as the results were, I mean, we've all seen the pictures from there. We all know what damage those bombs did. There are still people today who say, well, we had to do it. We had no choice.
Right.
Now, Greg Mitchell, when I first met you, we met on Twitter some years ago. You were writing for The Nation, and I didn't realize your background on this subject. You're the former editor of Nuclear Times magazine. I did not know that.
And I didn't, yeah.
Wow,
yeah.
And you have a number of books and projects on this subject. So this is your area of expertise, or one mm-hmm. of them anyway. What do you do you think that was a necessity, that we had to drop these bombs on Japan back to end World War II?
Well, you know, it's a great historical debate. And, you know, admittedly, it's not exactly black and white. There are arguments on all sides. I try to be respectful of all the different arguments. And there are a lot of good ones, a lot of evidence that can be interpreted in different ways. But I came after years of being sort of a little bit undecided myself to feel that the bomb should not have been used at that time, that Truman did have other alternatives. There were other options. He could have taken another day, another week, another month. Hmm. You know, the main argument is often that, you know, we saved a million lives because of we prevented an invasion. But, you know, an invasion was not even planned till November. You know, there was time to try other things rather than leave this legacy. Now, I mean, even putting aside the 150,000, 200,000 Japanese civilians who died, mainly women and children, even if you wanted to put those aside, and I don't want to, you still have this legacy of the use of the bomb, that the bomb was used. And so we have sort of the hype, which is these bombs are too terrible to be used, and yet we use them.
Yeah.
And it's so important today. You know, people might say, well, who, you know, why should we care about this movie? Why should we care that the bomb was used? We can't change it. But in fact, we can care about it, because what's been passed on to us largely by the media, which every year, now this is the 75th anniversary.
Yeah.
That's maybe why we're talking here.
Okay.
There will be a flood of stories soon about the bomb. And if it's the usual year in the media, the vast majority will support, you know, endorse the use of the bomb then. And the danger with that is that most people don't know is that we still have a first use policy, as it's officially known.
Wow.
It is still official U.S. policy to use the bomb as a first strike, not in retaliation to a nuclear attack. It's not fail safe or one of those things, but as a first strike. And, against a conventional attack or even just a threat. You know, there's headlines today about North Korea, with North Korea and their alleged bomb facilities and so on and so forth. So, you know, and of course, now we have a President Trump. And people sometimes joke about, he's got the nuclear codes, you know.
It's not funny.
If it's a small thing. But he has the codes and he has the policy, the first strike policy. And he has opinion polls. Recent opinion polls have shown that 40 to 50% of Americans would endorse a first strike on North Korea or Iran if we are threatened. So you come back to the same argument that was made with Japan, which was we wanted to save American lives, which, you know, we can trot out anytime we want, you know, end a war or end a threat. So this movie from almost 75 years ago, and the book, I hope, encapsulates all this. You know, it kind of shows how we got there and shows the arguments then that were brought to bear by Truman and the Pentagon to revise this movie, even to reshooting a key scene with Truman and getting the actor playing him fired.
Wow.
Interesting. Is that... you know, it's the same thing that drives us today with this Hiroshima narrative. We must toe the line on the utter necessity of using the bomb and making bigger, you know, bigger and more powerful bombs. So I'd like to think the book kind of captures all that in just, 280 pages.
Right. But what one of the things that's so fascinating about this is that an independent movie studio was making this big budget Hollywood blockbuster, as it was billed to be. And the administration gets wind of the storyline and says, wait a minute, we want to change that. And they did. I mean, about like today, if anything like that could ever happen. And I don't. Well, I guess it depends who's making the movie. Was MGM sympathetic to Truman? Was that why they allowed them some creative control over this film that was already in production?
Well, you know, it went down a road over the course of a few months. The first crucial decision was they made. They sat down with Truman in the Oval Office and pretty much gave him a script approval.
Wow.
Then they did a contract with General Leslie Groves, who was the head of the Manhattan Project, extremely right-wing, macho figure, Trumpian, you might say.
Great.
Contract with him and gave him $10,000, which was a small fortune then.
Back then.
And script approval. So he, as I was able to finally, after all these decades, document by going to the Motion Picture Academy library, going through every script, was able to chart when and how these revisions were made. You know, Groves had memos with, 50 changes he wanted in one fell swoop. And then it culminated in the following October when they finally had a Washington screening, and Truman's top aide attended and was, outraged about how his decision to use the bomb was pictured. And they, Truman agreed. Truman saw the script and they ordered a retake. So MGM, easy as pie. They went along with it word to word. The president and his press secretary rewrote the script,
oh,
or parts
God.
Of the script. And MGM took every word, filmed it exactly as it was dictated by the White House. So,
and as you said,
shocking or not after all this time.
Well, it kind of is. And they even replaced, as you said, the actor who was originally playing Truman. And there was already a directive that they could only shoot him from behind. So,
right. Yeah.
So I mentioned at the onset that there was an excerpt published in Mother Jones magazine. They also have a clip from the movie, which is the scene in the Oval Office where you see Truman from behind. I guess I'm going to play this clip. It's only 2.5 minutes. Hopefully I don't get copyright.
That is the scene they rewrote.
This is the rewritten scene. All right. So here we go. It's a clip from the beginning or the end. Here we go.
Charlie, I want to tell you our nation's top secret. It must remain just that, top secret.
Of course.
We have developed the most fearful weapon ever forged by man, an atomic bomb.
Even the word is frightening.
It's been tested, and it works. It's a harnessing of the basic power of the universe. In peacetime, atomic energy could be used to bring about a golden age, such an age of prosperity and well-being as the world has never known. In war, this same energy has destructive power almost beyond the comprehension of man.
It's clear now what the words prompt and utter destruction mean. Thank God we've got the bomb and not the Japanese. If they had it, they'd surely use it on us.
That's one argument for our using it, Charlie, but it's not the decisive argument.
The whole thing is terrifying. You must have spent many sleepless nights over it.
I've consulted with Mr. Churchill, with all my top military and naval advisors. I've talked with the civilian heads of our war effort. And all these advisors tell me the bomb will shorten the war by at least a year.
Where are we going to use it?
That's another question I had to think about. The Army has selected several Japanese cities as prime military targets because of war industries or military installations or troop concentrations or fortifications. We are going to shower all these places for 10 days with leaflets telling the population to leave, telling them what's coming. And we hope these warnings will save lives.
It should. And if the bomb shortens the war, it will save many thousands of American lives.
A year less of war, Charlie, will mean life for 300,000, maybe a 500,000 of America's finest youth. Not only that, but it'll mean life for thousands of British, of Russians, of Chinese, of Japanese.
These were the decisive considerations in my consent. As President of the United States, sir, you could make no other decision.
Wow.
As President, I could not.
Oh, my.
So I have told the Army to take the bomb to the Marianas, and when they receive the green light, to use it.
Oh, boy. That is, that's some pretty strong propaganda there. And so I'm guessing that's why the movie didn't do very well at the box office. Was it all that kind of pacing? Was in that kind of preaching?
Well, it's probably partly, but, you know, thanks to these revisions, the movie was delayed several months. And so what was seen, what was going to be a quick hit, a major movie, but get it out quickly after this incredibly historic event, was delayed, a year and a quarter. Mm. So by that time, people were starting to turn the page. But, the movie itself turned out to be pretty bad. Even the people who signed, we mentioned the Ayn Rand subplot in the book, which is quite lengthy in a way about the competing movie. But the another subplot is how MGM had to get the signed releases from all the famous scientists, Einstein, Oppenheimer, Leo Szilard, Enrico Fermi. And so they made desperate attempts to get these. And eventually all the scientists went along with it while mocking the movie, mocking the script in private. Yet they went along with it. So there wasn't really a profile of courage anywhere there, and you might say, but that's how, when the movie was released, it was accepted by the people who did see it as, well, this is fact. It's considered one of the early examples of the Hollywood docudrama.
Right.
And that was then as now, I suppose, seen as a mainly factual presentation. And I mean, we don't have time, but I could go through the scene you just saw with fact by fact.
Oh, I'll bet.
Things that are made up in it. That's the way it went, and it turned out to be significant, even though it was not it was not number one at the box office.
Right. So Donna Reed was not in this film. Her participation was only in getting her husband involved.
Inspiration. Yeah.
Okay. So I was wondering where she came into play. So Greg Mitchell. All right. So the Ayn Rand movie, they shelved that. They never did anything with it. This one got made. It wasn't the blockbuster it should have been. But you do again have a nod to one of the best movies on the subject, in my view anyway, Dr. Strangelove, which I haven't gotten through the whole book yet, but I don't think you deal with that movie in this book, do you? Just in the title?
Well, in the epilogue, we talk about other movies. I mean, I guess the main, and I have to say that maybe I was fated to do this book because when I was a teenager, my favorite movie was Dr. Strangelove. Mm-hmm. I still consider it maybe my all-time favorite movie, maybe the greatest movie of the post-war era. So I kind of feel like I was fated to do this. But the main point that they sort of make at the end of the book is that for some reason, and it's probably pretty clear what the reason is, in 75 years, Hollywood has only made 3 movies about the actual use of the bomb and the making and use of the bomb. There was this movie. MGM made another movie 5 years later about the pilot, Paul Tibbetts. And then not until 1990 when Roland Joffe made Fat Man and Little Boy, which some people will remember.
Right.
Those are the only 3 movies out of Hollywood in 75 years. Now, there have been many movies like Dr. Strangelove, like Failsafe. You can go down the list, War Game and so forth. That have touched on or been, really kind of brilliant treatments of nuclear fear, of nuclear threat. But for some reason, Hollywood will not tackle the origin story or the original sin, if you will. And it's because it's too tough a subject for Americans,
Right.
It's sort of like we did it. We did it. We kind of covered it up. We defended it to this day, 75 years later. And it's not like the Nazis, it's kind of easy to make movies about the Nazis because they weren't us. And actually, we then defeated them.
Mm-hmm.
But Hiroshima and Nagasaki were at our hand. Now, there's great debate over whether maybe it was acceptable. But, you know, it was at our hand and raises all those questions. It's very, one of the most revealing things about the movie, briefly, is simply that they, in the scripts as they were developed, they eliminated every single reference to Nagasaki.
Really?
So you can watch this movie and you'd never know there was a second bomb. And of course, the reason is that even many, many people who support the Hiroshima decision feel that Nagasaki was totally unnecessary, even a war crime. Mm. You know, Nagasaki is sometimes referred to as a war crime. And I would endorse that after, you know, my study and so forth. So, so it's kind of obvious why they would want to cut it out, but yet there it was. It was in the early scripts. It was, you know, a good part of the movie. And as the months went on, you know, it got jettisoned.
Wow.
And I think that, you know, you could just make that one statement and tell a lot about what the book is about, I suppose, and what the movie ended up being.
Well, it's a fascinating take on a story, a subject that we've talked about for 75 years now, to bring cinema into it and how the government coerced the filmmakers to try to, you know, propagandize it, I think is fascinating, because allegedly we don't have propaganda here, which, yeah, sorry, I can't say that with a straight face. But Greg Mitchell, in addition to this, the new book, of course, just out yesterday, The Beginning or the End, How Hollywood and America Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb. You wrote two other books on the subject. You have with Robert J. Lifton, Hiroshima in America, and the second book, Atomic Cover-Up. So as we are in the 75th year, what do you want people to take away from the experience? What do you want them to think 75 years later about what we did, this original sin, if you will?
Well, I mean, there's a lot that could be said, but as I said earlier, I think if you want to take an activist view, what can we do now? And I guess it would be to write, talk, speak out, whatever you can. There will be demonstrations coming up for August 6th and August 9th. Whatever can be done to rescind this first use policy, it's debated by the experts every year. There's always, sometimes there are things introduced in Congress. Make this a story about today and this very, very dangerous precedent we set in 1945, which as long as we continue to endorse it, it lays the groundwork for use again, because the same arguments can be made today.
Absolutely. And you did say, Dr. Strangelove, one of your favorite films. Would you recommend that people then go watch that after reading your book? Because just to give you a little, I don't know, different perspective on things.
Well, I suppose maybe it's not a different perspective. It's no, sort of what one thing leads to the next, you know, and I don't know whether Trump is more General Jack D. Ripper or more Dr. Strangelove, but it's kind of humorous that people find General Ripper, you know, so over the edge, and that could never happen today. When in fact, General Ripper had to take over that base and mess with the security codes, where we have a president who appears to be just as nutty, who has the nuclear codes in the briefcase next to him every day.
That's so, right.
Maybe it's not so funny.
No, Dr. maybe Strangel's, not.
It's kind of hysterical, right? Dark humor, but we're living in a dark humor era that's maybe not so funny.
No, and I'll repeat what I've said so many times, that nobody, if you wrote the script of what we're going through today, Donald Trump becomes president, has the nuclear codes. We have, in addition to everything else that's gone on in the last 3.5 years, then we come down with this global pandemic of COVID-19, and we're all walking around wearing face masks, and except for the president. You couldn't get a movie like that made, because it would be too far out of the realm of conceivable possibilities, and yet here we are. So I guess they say truth is stranger than fiction. Anyway, Greg Mitchell, the book is now out, The Beginning or the End, and maybe you'll want to go back and watch this movie. I guess with the streaming, everything, anything is possible. Thank you so much, Greg. It's a pleasure to talk with you. We've talked online for years, and I don't think we've ever done this before. So I really appreciate you coming on today.
Very happy to be here. Thanks.
All right. You take care. Bye-bye. All right. And with that, we're done. We'll see you tomorrow. It's Thursday. Howie Klein will be here, and the Supreme Court. Ugh. Keep your fingers crossed.